You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Hey everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. Well, as you know, for the last several months, we have been concentrating on a time period from the mid-50s to the late-50s, and specifically 1957, which was just, as I said a couple of weeks ago, a treasure trove of monster movies for those of us growing up during the 60s as monster kids. And I've picked out another one today that we did talk about several seasons ago. And it's one that I just had an affinity for. Every time I saw this movie, was listed for Monster Movie Matinee, I had to watch it. And I just have such fond memories of this movie. And I'm sure the last time I talked about it, I mentioned that as well. But I want to go a little further into why this film has become such a cult favorite among those of us monster kids growing up and a new audience of monster kids that came after us. We're talking about The Brain from Planet Aris. It became such a cult favorite that one of its stars, Joyce Meadows, when she was contacted about doing her first autograph show back in the 80s, found out just how popular the movie was when she tried to buy an old movie poster of it. And it was the collector said, yeah, it's going to cost $685. And she says, my God, it didn't even cost that much to make the movie. Well, it did cost a little more to make the movie, but she was as stunned as a lot of people that it gained the notoriety that it gained in the cult status. And a lot of folks my age have grabbed this film as just a favorite of theirs from childhood. Maybe we can figure it out on this episode of Monster Attack, because there are just some fun things about this film, I guess, that really attracted me as a kid. But as movies go, it's thrown together pretty quick. It's a very, very low-budget film. It was shot at only $58,000, which wasn't much in 1957. It was released on a double bill with another low-budget film from Hauco Releasing. Hauco was known for releasing double features of B-movies and low-budget films. So I couldn't find any information on how much money it has made since its release or upon its early release. But I got to say, folks, you can get it on DVD and Blu-ray. It's available on a couple of streaming services. I found it on a retro streaming service last night. I have a digital copy of it from my collection, but I just wanted to see how hard it was to find. And if you've got a Roku stick, you can find it very easily on a service called Retro 2, sci-fi, fantasy, and monster movies. It's very, very easy to find. It's one of the Roku channels out there. So, and I'm sure it's on others as well. So it's an easy movie to find. It gets a lot of showing. I think even TCM has shown it a couple of times. And it's just come down as a cult classic that was released 65 years ago. In fact, when we're recording this episode, we are just a couple of weeks away from its actual 65th anniversary, which was October 1st of 1957. So I thought that was also appropriate as well, since we've been concentrating so much on these 57 films. I had no idea how many wild films came out during this 1 year alone. I mean, it was, boy, if I had been a teenager in 1957, I would have gone crazy. You could have gone to a movie almost every week and found one that was sort of fun to go watch. So let's talk about The Brain from Planet Aris. It has been copied. It has been spoofed. It has been quoted. Sharp-eyed viewers that were fans of the show Malcolm in the Middle. Malcolm in the Middle uses a clip from the movie in there. I remember the first time I saw Malcolm, I was like, whoa, wait a minute, that's Brain from Planet Aris. I mean, there's just so much that I remember. One particular scene, which we will talk about in a little bit here, that always stands out when I think of Brain from Planet Aris. But when I watched it last night, I thought, okay, you know, this time I'm going to have fun with it. I mean, I want to watch it for enjoyment, but I also want to sort of see, okay, what are some of the things that really attracted me to it as a kid? Because I saw this when I was about 8 or 9 years old. So that's when I saw a lot of these great 50 films coming out onto the monster circuit. You know, they rushed them out there when they saw what Universal was doing with their shock package and their shock theater 2 package. And they tried to, you know, try to get theirs out as fast as they could because they saw the market for monster movies amongst kids my age during that time period in the early 60s. And then all of these monster movie shows started popping up. And next thing you know, it became quite a thing. So let's talk a little bit about who's in it. And of course, I think that's got a lot to do with one of the appeals that the show had for me as a kid, and it stars John Agar. We have talked about John Agar a lot on this show, and John is definitely one of my favorite character actors from monster movies and sci-fis and low-budget films. My mom's maiden name was Agar, but John Agar was from another branch of Agars when I was doing the genealogy on Mom and my family here. I was sort of hoping that maybe there would be a link up with John Agar, but he came from another bunch that settled in Minnesota and in the Midwest. So close, but a good Irish name. Nearly 100 credits. He was recognized, I guess, you know, mainly because he married Shirley Temple while he was still in the Army, served in World War II, and became good friends with John Wayne. And John Wayne got him into acting. He acted in a couple of war pictures like Sands of Iwo Jima and also got him into some Westerns and things. And then he just started moving on from there. Of course, some people sort of thought poorly of John when he divorced Shirley Temple and some of the comments that he had made in the divorce trial because, you know, she was America's sweetheart. So, you know, John was in an unwinnable situation there where no matter what he said, he was going to be the wrong guy on that one in the eyes of a lot of people. A lot of people, you know, said that, you know, his acting style was stiff. And I sort of fell into that category, but I didn't care as a kid because he was in all these really great monster movies that I loved watching. John had a style. He had a style. I think he learned from John Wayne on that because John Wayne was very similar. When you saw John Wayne in a movie, he was John Wayne, but the character channeled through him. You know, he was always John Wayne, but it was how this character was, you know, was as far as John Wayne goes. He made the character become him. And I think John Agar did the similar thing. When you saw a movie that John Agar was in, yeah, he was pretty much John Agar. He had a certain persona on screen that was very appealing. And so, yeah, it may, you know, to the critics' order, might have been a little stiff or wooden or whatever. But the more I have studied John Agar's movies and gone back over and over again and really specifically keyed in on his acting style, it was like, no, he's not that bad. He's not that bad. And this movie gives him a chance to just go over the top. I don't know. I can't speak for John Agar. I wish I'd had a chance to meet him. Now, Mark has met him. He met him while he was still alive and remarked to me that John Agar was just so surprised at how many people were fans of his because of the monster movies and the sci-fis. Because it was well known that Agar in many, many interviews said he would not apologize for the movies that he made. He said they provided him with a good living. He had a lot of fun making them, and he had no apologies to make for making some of the low-budget films he did because he just enjoyed what he was doing. It appeared to be entertaining people, and that was good enough for him. And, you know, that's a pretty good, realistic, down-to-earth approach to take from a cult actor making all these terrific films that we remember as kids. So I would have loved to have meet this guy, and I would have loved to have asked him about his thoughts and his memories on making The Brain from Planet Aris. As we mentioned, one of his co-stars, Joyce Meadows, not to be confused with Jane or Audrey Meadows. And I know for years I thought they were related when I saw that name, but Joyce Meadows was totally different. She had changed her name to Meadows well before Audrey Meadows and Jane Meadows changed their stage names. And she went on to a career all of her own. And of course, she plays the lead female in this. And this is one of those rare times, and I'm going to kid John a little bit on this one, that it seemed like every time John Agar was in a monster movie, he always went after the lead female, and always tried to get her and fall in love with her and all of that. This is one of those rare times where he doesn't do that because they're already engaged to be married. Joyce plays a character by the name of Sally Fallon, and it's established very early on. They have been boyfriend and girlfriend for a long time. They live out in the middle of Arizona where John's character is conducting nuclear experiments. Of course, his character is a big nuclear physicist type, a big nuclear scientist. And so he's on a grant from the government to study nuclear energy. And again, remember, this is 1957. So we're still pretty new when it comes to what we know about nuclear power. And part of the movie centers around a big atomic bomb test that is going on. John Agar's character's name is Steve Marsh. And, of course, he's well-known by the military for the research that he's done. And that sort of sets things in motion here. So he and Sally engaged to be married. And we meet her father, played by Thomas Brown Henry. And we've talked about Thomas quite a bit. In fact, not too long ago, in a couple of movies that we've done, he showed up in so many other things. I mean, he was at 20 Million Miles to Earth, Earth versus the Flying Saucer. I think I always remember him for that film, for a line he gave when he's asked, so we're going to meet the alien, the alien flying saucers with force. And he says, when a people come to this country with hostile intentions, you don't greet them with tea and cookies or something to that nature. He always played like a general or an authoritative figure. In this one, he's a guy that is involved with the government a little bit. It has something to do with it, with the grant that Steve Marsh is working under as he's researching nuclear energy. So we've got a lot of old favorites in this, and I think this goes a long way into making this film very appealing for me as well as a kid growing up. It's like, I'm seeing all these familiar faces. Another one that a lot of folks will recognize from this film too is Robert Fuller. Robert Fuller, for a couple of generations, not only my generation, for the regular part that he had on Laramie, the big TV Western, but also, for the next generation behind me, for Emergency, the Jack Webb series. And he's a very familiar face, and you'll recognize his face almost immediately if you're not familiar with his earlier career. He didn't start out as an actor as a kid. His family moved all over the place after his father had died and his mother remarried, and they relocated to several different places. Robert admitted that he did not like school and so didn't do well in school. So very early on, he went to work. He ended up having one sort of interesting job that sort of indirectly got him involved with acting, and that was he was assistant manager for Grauman's Chinese Theater. His mother was an accomplished actress and dancer, and his stepfather also became a very accomplished dancer. They were teaching dancing to people and to kids in Florida, and then they moved to Hollywood. And both started doing a little acting there as well. And that got Robert sort of into it. He joined the Screen Extras Guild, so did a lot of extra work on a ton of films, and then was discovered by a studio that offered him some regular work. In fact, he was offered a television series that he turned down initially. It was one starring Ray Milland. It was a crime drama. And the head of the studio was a little surprised when he turned it down, but it didn't hold it against Robert. And then he was offered the Laramie role, which was a role that a lot of us our age remember him for. And he was known, you know, he did a lot of Westerns. You know, again, I can't say enough how many Westerns came out during the 50s on television, but he appeared in a lot of them. And most of his big fans, you know, just, love him for the Western work that he did. The last television appearance that he made was on Walker, Texas Ranger, the original one, the one with Chuck Norris, much to the delight of several of his fans who saw him come back and reprise a, sort of a, you know, a cowboy Western type role that they long remembered him for. This is his very first screen role. So he gets his start on Brain from Planet Aris, and he's playing the assistant, Dan Murphy, the assistant to John Agar's Steve March character. And they're working on, on studying radiation and things of that nature. Before I get to the rest of the cast, there's just a few others that that you might recognize here, just a couple, and a couple I want to mention. The film starts with seeing this light, and it's a nice desert shot, of a mountain out in the desert, and we see this light coming over the crest of this mountain and coming down, and then all of a sudden a big explosion. And then we cut to John Agar's character, Steve March, and he's studying some instruments in his laboratory and mentions to Dan that there's something weird going on. He can't understand it. He's getting this burst of radioactivity, and Dan's like, well, you know, that happens. Could be a solar flare, yeah. And March is like, no. It's not that. He said, this is really strange. Now, Dan's over in the corner of the lab. He's reading a science fiction magazine, which sort of establishes it. So he's, and they sort of, make light of the fact he's the young, good-looking guy. He's single, and he's always on the prowl. You know, they live out in the desert, so when they get a chance, they live close to Las Vegas, of course, because that's the closest big city where all of the nuclear tests were done. Dan would, hit the high town now and then. But, as he is talking to Steve, all of a sudden they get another burst of this radioactive activity, and it's coming from that mountain. So they decide, well, I guess we're going to have to go to that mountain, which, as everybody tells them, boy, this is not a good time of the year to go to that mountain. Boy, it's going to be about 120 degrees out there. You know, there's absolutely no shade. It's brutal, the worst part of the desert. Sally is saying you shouldn't be going out there. You know, the Mystery Mountain is the name of the mountain that they're going out to find out what's going on with this thing. So we establish very quickly all of the interaction of these three characters and Thomas Brown Henry's character, John Fallon. I mean, they waste no time. It's like within 15 minutes, we've got a chance to meet these four main characters and move from there. Now, let me mention really quickly the director. And, it was directed by Nathan Jurin. Now, you'll recognize the name Nathan Jurin. We've talked about him on this show quite a bit. I'm trying to think. Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, when we did that show, and Nathan was the director of that. He directed a lot of films that we have talked about here. And one in particular, his very last film in 1973 that Mark and I talked about, and that was The Boy Who Cried Werewolf. So Nathan was so embarrassed by this film when it came out. He was so embarrassed that he took on a pseudonym, Nathan Hertz. So if you watch this film, you'll see that it's directed by Nathan Hertz. I think you may have taken this a little too hard. I mean, yes, the film has problems or whatever. Yeah, because it's low budget and the writing by Ray Buffum, who wrote a lot of screenplays for this company that made and distributed Brain from Planet Aris. I mean, it's a little goofy. Goofy, I guess, is the best name. I want to speak lovingly of this film because I don't think it's a bad movie. It's just it's one of those that's just very, very fun to watch, and it's very efficient. When I use that word efficient, boy, are they! I mean, it's efficient. Like we established these four characters. Right that I just mentioned to you very, very quickly here and then move on. And see, as a kid, 8 or 9 years old, I still wasn't into really analyzing films or that sort of thing. So I like the fact that they cut to the chase so quick. we got to see everything really, really fast in this. And the story is very simple. You've got Dan and Steve heading out into the desert following a little hamburger lunch by Sally, who insisted they eat because they'd been locked in that lab for so long. And they're always working, and now heading out to the desert. She wanted to make sure at least they were fed before they fried to death. So Dan and Steve get out there as far as they can go, and they realize they've got a little farther to go. Steve notices a strange pile of rocks, a large pile of rocks, at one part that they're going to have to walk down to. He says that wasn't there last year. He's got this place memorized. And the readings are, you know, still showing them that it's coming from that area. And then the radiation stops. You know, so it's the intermittent thing that just drives them crazy. So they head down towards these rocks and they find this big cave. And the big cave looks like it had just been carved out. He says, this wasn't here before. That's what these rocks are from. Someone has carved this cave out. Well, that's the big explosion we saw in the beginning. Hey, did I mention I'm going to probably spoil everything about this movie that there is to spoil? I should have mentioned that. Of course, you know that with Monster Attack. We go into some detail and end up spoiling the movie. If you haven't seen Brain from Planet Oris, yep, spoilers ahead as we now get ready to come into the good stuff. I still think you'll enjoy the film, even if you know what's going to happen and all that. But, you know, this could be a nice time to hit the pause button and then come back to us after you see the film. Anyway, okay, I feel better when I say that, so I don't want anyone thinking, Jim, you just spoiled everything. So they get to this cave, and they're not finding anything. And then all of a sudden, the Geiger counter goes nuts and goes crazy on them. And there's a big flash of light that they see, and they don't know what that's from. And then we meet one of our monsters. Because there's two of them. Yeah, well, see, that's the first spoiler alert. There's two of them. And it's a big brain, and it looks like a superimposed brain on the screen, you know. So it's a little bit translucent, and it's floating up there. And I got to tell you about the guy playing the brain. The guy playing the brain, and again, it's not a guy in a suit. I mean, they've got a big brain that they've superimposed on the screen. Dale Tate is his name. Dale Tate, longtime Hollywood guy, worked on a ton of movies in a variety of different ways. He was a producer of some films, an actor of a few, like in this one, and he was voice acting in this. He does the voice of this brain that we meet, but he was involved with visual effects, all kinds of different crew jobs, you know, what they call additional crew and stuff, right up until 1989. And then he stayed with us until 2004. He passed away at the age of 84. He had quite a career. And he does a fun job with this one because this brain is evil. And his name is Gore. And it's power hungry. And it was going to take over the planet. And it considers the humans on the planet insignificant, easy to take over. One thing that I always notice in these 57 films is it's a great chance for people in the movie business to use military hardware and military weaponry because there was so much surplus stuff that came back from World War II. So Dan is carrying an M1 carbine, which I actually own one myself, an old M1 carbine. That's in my collection. And Dan's got his 45, you know, the standard stock sidearm that most officers had in the war. And so, you know, the chance to show off a little military hardware there. And they fire at the thing. Nothing happens. They throw stuff at it. Nothing happens. It just goes. It's like throwing at a projection. It's not a solid type entity at this point. And it kills Dan immediately. Big flash of light and boom, Dan is burned to death. Now, we don't see it in great detail, but the description of it, you know, it's like extreme radioactive burning. But John Agar, he passes out and the brain, we see, go down into his body. So now we know, okay, we got a little brain possession thing going on here. Does that remind you of any other film? Yeah, it might remind you of a film we talked about several seasons ago called Donovan's Brain, which was a favorite of mine. But this one, between the two, I like this one better. I think this one had a little more action to it. Donovan's Brain was more of a thinking man's monster movie. But then it dealt with an evil brain taking over, you know, another guy's body or whatever. So, you know, very, very similar, very, very similar stories. And from what I understand, there was a novel, a sci-fi novel that came out about this time, a few years before, that dealt with that as well. So a lot of people have always assumed that Brain from Planet Oris was influenced by this novel that came out, and that maybe Ray Buffum got the idea of, hey, let's have a brain and, you know, from outer space possessing this guy. So now Steve is under the control of this evil brain. And then we cut back to where we see Sally, and she's talking to her father, and she's, you know, very upset that they've been gone a week. They were only going to be gone maybe a couple of days, but apparently they tend to do this sort of thing if they find something. And while she's talking to her father, we see Steve show up, but he looks a little different. This is where I think John Agar probably had fun. I'm going to assume that he had a lot of fun making this movie, because, you know, he had to do a lot of acting with his mannerisms and his eyes, and he got to be a little over the top. I think Nathan Jerram gave him a lot of liberty as to being over the top. And this is where some of the critics got down on this film a little bit, because the acting is over the top in some regards. At least when it comes to the Steve March character. When he's possessed by the brain boy, he just really chews the scenery up. And I think for any actor, that could be a lot of fun. If you've got permission to do that, I mean, you could really, really go to town. But Sally hangs up the phone, and then here he is. Prodigal son has returned, as he says. And, all of a sudden, they get very amorous. Now, remember, this movie was coming out on Monster Movie Matinee in the early 60s. I think, and I can't say this for sure, but I have a feeling they cut some of this movie a little bit on the first showing of it that I saw, because I remember when I saw it years later, you know, when I bought my first VHS tape of it, I don't remember them being that amorous in the movies that I saw. So I think they had to cut some of it, because I got thinking, boy, for 1957, this is a little racy, but for, you know, television of 1962, 63 or whatever, this is really, really racy. And he's almost on the verge of raping her, before she stops him, says, "What's got into you?" And she's starting to get a little disturbed that maybe Steve is not who he is. And where's Dan? He says, "Oh, Dan took off in Vegas, you know, he cooped up in the desert for a week. He's got to go, you know, get some action and all that stuff." And she said, "It doesn't sound like Dan." But, you know, then again, Steve is not sounding like Steve. So that sets into motion this sub-story that, you know, what is going on with Steve? His emotions jump from being good old Steve, who's madly in love with Sally, to this manic-type Steve who's saying, "Yeah, you know, you just wait. I've got something I'm setting up with the military, and it's going to be big, and we're going to be rich, and we're going to be famous and powerful." And she says, "Oh, is that what you care about, is power and all that?" "Oh, yeah, that's what everybody wants." And, you know, you can see the wheels spinning in her mind. That's like, this is not the guy she was engaged to. You know, who is this guy? What happened to him out there? And what happened to Dan? We get the impression that Sally, you know, she likes Dan a lot, too. Of course, Dan's a little young for her, but, you know, John's the guy, you know, Steve is the guy that she's engaged to, but, you know, still, if Steve hadn't been around, she'd probably go after Dan. You know, that's just sort of the impression you get watching this film. But we find out Steve sets up a lot of things in motion. He calls the military, the Indian Springs nuclear test site, where they're going to test this new atomic bomb. He wants to be a part of it. They said, "Oh, sure, yeah, absolutely, love to have you along, and, as an observer and all of that." And this is, where he tells Sally, and this is stretched out over, you know, a little period of time at development in the film. Like I said, I'm cutting to the chase as to, you know, this is the stuff I loved, because as a kid, I'm eating this all up. It's like, oh, man, this is the evil guy. What's he going to do? You know, this is not going to be good. But he's got this all in motion, and he keeps telling Sally that, you know, after this meeting and, you know, after I go to this nuclear test, it's going to be different for us, all going to be different for us. You know, everybody's, you know, I'm going to have everything that I want for all of us, you know, and that sort of thing. And she's just very mystified by all of this. We've got a quick scene, which you might think is a throwaway scene. It's not a throwaway scene at all. But it really sets the table for things to come, where Dan is out driving in the desert. He's heading home, and this plane flies overhead, and he looks up. And the special effects, by the way, the special effects makeup, by the way, is by Jack Pierce. So Jack, you know, a long, long time makeup guy, known for Frankenstein and some of the old Universal classics. It's basically IFX. They use some special lenses with some foil in there that will reflect light. John Agar said they're extremely uncomfortable. And, you know, that sort of added to the role, because whenever he turns into this possessed Steve Marsh, and the eyes, so the eyes go, I can't, almost like going black, but then they shine a light on him so that they sort of glow as well. It's a great little effect. I mean, it really is a nice little effect for back then. I could see that, you know, they're so uncomfortable, because then he gets this sort of grimace on his face. And I think it sort of adds to him, you know, trying to portray evil from this guy, because he looks up at this plane and he blows it up with his mind. So we're like, wow, you know, this guy's got some, you know, abilities, some powers, this alien guy, to do that. And now he's going to an atomic bomb test. There's no telling what he's going to do. So there's another sub story going on. Sally starts talking to her father and says, I'm really concerned about Dan. Dan is still not back. This is not like him. I want to go to Mystery Mountain and see if we can find any kind of evidence of what's going on with Dan, because I think something's wrong. I think Steve is holding back on us. He's not telling us everything. Father agrees. He says, well, I've known better than to, you know, try to argue with you on what you want to do. And they drive out to the desert. They find the cave, and they find another brain. And all of a sudden, you know, as a kid, I'm going, uh-oh, here we go. Oh, my God, this must be the invasion, you know. But it's a good brain. A good brain. And, again, he also voiced by this guy, Dale Tate, who, again, was, you know, very, very long-time Hollywood guy behind the scenes. And Dale does a nice job of this. So he does both voices for both brains, and it really does a good job. I think, you know, he can pat himself on the back on that. So the good brain, known as Vol, explains that Gore is an escaped criminal from his planet Arrus, and he has come to the Earth because he feels like that he can take over the Earth, and then he can use this as a jump off to not only take over the Earth, but maybe take over other planets as well. I mean, you know, he's just totally power hungry and very, very dangerous. Vol tells them, he says, you're right about Steve. You know, if you felt it, you know, he's been acting different and all that. And she goes, oh, my, that's exactly what he's doing. And he says, he's been possessed. He's been possessed by Gore, and explains how, you know, how that is all working. And he says, I need a human body I can possess, that I can go into, so that I can help stop Gore. But I can't, you know, he can't suspect that I'm around or whatever. She volunteers, the father volunteers, but then they get thinking, they go, what about the dog? And there's a wonderful white Labrador in this movie, known as George. George didn't get a credit in the movie. Usually they give the dogs credit, but they didn't in this one. But I've seen this dog in a lot of movies from the 50s. So I think maybe George is the name he performs under, but great dog, great expressive dog. And this is another reason I think I really loved Brain from Planet Arrus, because now you've got, I won't say a talking dog, you know, it's not like a Walt Disney thing, but you've got Vol in George, and, you know, and he doesn't talk while he's in George, but but I'll tell you what, George is totally believable. I tell you, he just is totally believable. Now here we got a guy, or we got a dog, I should say, not a guy. I think of him as a person in this movie, that hangs around Steve enough so he can keep an eye on him. And Steve won't suspect anything because George, he's used to George being around him. We've got a couple of scenes set up where Steve gets alone with Sally, and all he wants to do is get amorous with her. See, and I think this was an element of the film that might have been trimmed a little bit and cut a little bit, because I don't think the censors would have allowed that for, like, kids' fare in 1962 or 1963 on television. I think they would have had some problems with that. So they probably had to tone the movie down a little bit, because there is another scene where he gets physically almost very, very violent while he's trying to get amorous with Sally, and the dog stops him. So, you know, and then we really, you know, we can really see, you know, the evil behind this Gore character. Well, to make a long story short, he goes to this atomic test, and while he's meeting with all the generals and the colonels and the government people, and he convinces them, you know, they said, you know, this is a private meeting here, but, you know, we'll be back in a few minutes and join you for the nuclear or the atomic test. But he talks them into it. Two minutes. He wants to give him a presentation just to tell something to them, and basically tells them, I'm going to take over the world and you're going to help me and I'm going to show you what I can do. And he basically doesn't explode the atomic bomb early, but they've got a little fake city set up, like the military used to do to test what kind of effect an atomic bomb would have on a city or whatever. And he blows it up, and they go, my God, he just did that with his mind. He also blows up a plane, and one of the colonels at the meeting jumps out with a .45 and starts blasting him. And he blows him, or doesn't blow him up, but he kills him. He absolutely fries him. So they give in. I mean, what can they do? I mean, he's got enough power to destroy the world, it looks like. And they're going to give him whatever he wants. And he's got a big meeting set up for the next day at 8 o'clock at night. Well, while he's back at his, he gets back to his lab, and he's confronted by the sheriff. They have found the body of Dan because Sally and her father had found Dan's body when they met Vol. And, of course, what happens, Steve in the guise of Gore, or I should say Gore in the guise of Steve, kills the sheriff as well. It all leads up to a big confrontation where we learn that the only vulnerability that Gore has is that there's, for every 24 hours, he has to come out of the body and take on his full physical shape, not the projected looking type shape, but the physical shape to absorb enough oxygen to sustain himself. And then he can go back into the body again. There is a part of the brain called the Fissure of Rolando. Now, one of the goofs and gaffes in this movie, and in a $58,000 budget, you got to let it ride. And I guess Nathan had to let it ride because Joyce Meadows got it wrong. She, a couple times when she was learning about this, called it the Fissure of Orlando. No, it's not a Floridian brain. It's Rolando. And that's sort of that big fold in the brain. If you've seen a picture of a brain, right down the center of the cerebellum is the Fissure of Rolando. And if you hit that, you take out Gore. You know, that's the only way you can take him out. So they're all primed to figure out some way that they can capture Gore in that situation. And Sally shows up at the laboratory, and through a whole series of events, Gore manifests himself. She's hiding in there, waiting for Steve to come back, and so that she can catch him when he manifests himself, and unfortunately gives herself away when she stumbles over the body of the sheriff and screams. And this is the scene that I always remember. It's a great scene where she'd been hiding behind some cabinets and tables and stuff in the laboratory. She screams, and then the brain comes flying around the corner and confronts her. And, of course, now at this point, John Agar is okay. And Sally has left him a clue as to what Gore's weakness is. And he sees that and realizes what she's trying to say. So he grabs this fire axe that's in the lab and starts whacking away at Gore. And before you know it, Gore is gone. And everything is all happy ending. Now, one thing I got a big kick out of the last few times that I saw Brain from Planet Oris is that Vol had told Sally and her father, because they said, boy, if Gore is as powerful and dangerous a criminal as he is, how are we going to stop him? He goes, don't worry, my powers are more powerful than his, and I'll stop him. However, at no time in this movie does Vol ever stop Gore. He just sort of sits back. George just sits back. He's still in the dog going, oh, okay, you guys handle it. Looks like you got it under control. Again, this is, a $58,000 budget. You just got to go flying through the film as fast as you can. But the dog being possessed, the brains, like that one big scene where the brain is chasing Sally around the lab, yes, the planes blowing up, well, I can't say it was cool. They're obviously model planes on a string. I guess they probably got a firecracker in them that blows them up. But still, as a kid, I love this. I love this movie. It just moves right along. A lot of familiar faces, you know, like John Agar and Joyce Meadows and Thomas Brown Henry and others. And there's one other one that I didn't mention, Ken Terrell. Ken Terrell, a lot of you folks will recognize from, played in all kinds of television and stuff right up until 1962. He's from Georgia as well, and originally planned to attend Georgia Tech and play football for them, but he was too small and didn't make the team. So he ends up going to like a Charles Atlas type guy and becoming a bodybuilder and known for his physique. But I remember him later on in his later years with appearances in Attack of the 50-Foot Woman, The Purple Monster, Strikes Again, some of those serials that he was in and stuff. He was in Mysterious Dr. Satan. He was just in a lot of fun movies, almost 200 to his credit. And his last appearance was as a river pirate in How the West Was Won. So I just did a variety of different things as a character actor. And again, it's one of those guys, you'll recognize his face. You'll say, yeah, I remember him. And a very, very familiar character. And he plays one of the generals in the movie. But there's just so many elements about this that are just so much fun for kids. And you know, so every time I see Braden from Planet RS, it transports me back to the early 1960s and those great Saturday afternoons or Saturday evenings where I couldn't wait to see what the movie of the week was, you know, what was going to entertain me that Saturday afternoon from 1 o'clock until 2:30 or later on, you know, from 11:30 until 1 a.m. Just a great time. So in spite of all of its little flaws and inconsistencies and goofiness and all that, it's become just a fun cult film. Get a lot of people together, pop up a lot of popcorn and have a good time with the Brain for Planet Aris. Because like I said, between the two Brain movies that I remember growing up, Brain from Planet Aris and Donovan's Brain, this is the one I always loved. And not to say that I didn't like Donovan's Brain, I think the world of that film. But that film became more important to me as I got older, because then I became a little more discriminating, and I liked the cerebral films as I got older. But Aris was, you know, I was still a kid, and just like, show me the monster, show me the monster and have some fun with it, you know, and blow some things up and whatever. And give me a happy ending. And, you know, so for a kid of 8 or 9 years old, that was the way to go. 1957, what a great year. And I am going to continue looking for movies that I saw from 1957, to finish out this season, because we're having so much fun with this. And I hope you are too. On these episodes of Monster Attack, I have gotten just some great, great letters from you guys recently, and it's been terrific, because I know this has been a crazy season for us. I have a lot of stuff going on personally right now where, you know, I had to take a couple of weeks off for my vacation and stuff. I've got a move coming up. I don't think I'm going to miss any episodes, hopefully not, for that, trying to prepare for that. Just, it's been a nuts year, but a fun one as well. And Mark, I talked to yesterday, he is definitely going to be with us in about another week. So hang on. Yeah, he had a couple of unexpected things come up, but we've got a very special film prepared for you guys coming up in just a week or so here on Monster Attack. So thank you so much for the kind letters. You don't know how much they make my day when I get them. Some of the stories that you guys tell me about the impact these films had on your lives. I mean, it really is. It's hard to explain to anyone, isn't it, folks? Unless you're one of us, one of a monster kid, you know what I'm talking about. Have a great week, folks, and we will see you on Monday.
It was the dawn of another podcast. The Epsilon 3 is a dream given form. It's a home away from home for three guys to watch a 90s sci-fi classic TV show. Three guys with microphones over 3,249 miles apart, all alone in the night. The year is 2021. The name of the station is Babylon 5. The name of the podcast is the Epsilon 3. Veer, bring me a drink.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.